Welcome to another episode in the Neon Jazz interview series with the very accomplished pianist, composer, music director, and bandleader, Kansas City's very own Eddie Moore. Born in Los Angeles, raised in Texas, and picking Kansas City as his home, he joins a KC town in the midst of a jazz renaissance, bringing his flavor with his band, The Outer Circle, and many other projects to keep him busy and the fans happy. Over the course of our interview, we hit a wide range of topics to help you get to know Eddie better, along with his music and his story. Dig it.
Hey, it's Joe DeMeo, Neon Jazz. How are you?
I'm good.
Good, man. Hey, thank you for taking some time out to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, for sure.
Cool. Hey, I'm going to go ahead and dive right in here and ask you, what has been going on with you lately?
Recording and finishing our second project. Recently just finished up our last session. And then just been playing a lot, traveling a lot, and playing a lot of different bands as well as The Outer Circle.
When's the next project coming out? Do you have an estimated date?
I don't have a date. Probably be summer of 2015 for sure, but as far as a exact date, I'm not sure.
You grew up in L.A. How did growing up in Los Angeles cultivate a love for jazz for you?
I actually grew up in Houston, Texas. I was born in Los Angeles.
I got you. So how did the environment that you were in Texas, how did that lend to your love of jazz?
I grew up with my father for the most part, and his love for music, or my parents' love for music, come from a musical family. My dad's a huge fan of Miles Davis and John Coltrane. And so I grew up listening to jazz along with, you know, hip-hop and Frank Zappa or a lot of different eclectic music. I'd say my love for jazz started there. I didn't really start diving into jazz as a musician until, you know, I was like 20. I guess what drew me to that is, you know, listening to bands or groups like Tribe Called Quest and Jill Scott and Mos Def and Black Star with Talib and Mos Def and these groups that are like, you know, hip hop. I'm 29, so grew up at the skate park, skating to a lot of that stuff. I'd be the guy with the radio and we were listening to a lot of that. And as a musician or a classical musician, I realized it was definitely jazz influence between the harmony and, you know, on Tribe Called Quest albums, they got Ron Carter and jazz samples, you know, in the music. And so I wanted to originally be a producer, and I realized I needed to learn about jazz and that type of harmony to be able to play the piano like that. And once I, you know, kind of went down that lane and got deeper into it, I just got more into wanting to play jazz and because of the freedom that it allows as a musician.
You know, and you could have done anything. It says in your bio that you're a prodigy. You started out on the piano, mastered the violin and percussion by your teens. So has it just been something woven into your DNA? Music just makes sense and it's been easy for you?
It makes sense. I wouldn't say it's been easy by any means, no. Yeah, I've been playing for a while. My mom made me play piano since I was four. You know, when I was the age of four, she dropped me off in piano lessons. Been playing classical, and then I learned how to play the violin, you know, like middle school, and then dabbled around in that, and I played percussion in high school, you know, growing up in Texas. It's all about marching band and football. So I played football and did a lot of things. When I was younger, it really wasn't about music. Like I said, I grew up at the skate park, so every day, you know, I was sponsored for rollerblading and BMX at a time where we were doing that every day for hours and hours. Yeah. And music was more like a chore at first. But as more as I got into it, maybe like high school and then, of course, college, just getting way more serious about it.
So it mentioned, too, that you won a lot of competitions there around the high school years of your life. Was there just any competition that made sense? Did you get into and really kind of cultivate your skill level?
No, I mean, in high school, it was mainly solo and ensemble type of things. You know, competed in state for percussion on marimba and ensembles like that in high school, you know, when percussion was more of a serious thing in my life. I didn't really start taking piano and jazz serious until college, so I went to undergraduate. Like, I didn't learn how to play jazz piano until I went to undergraduate.
So all of these music influences you mentioned, Miles Davis, Tribe Called Quest, Earth, Wind & Fire, Zappa, and even the study of Western classical, how is all of that voted for your music brain and the way you approach music, whether it's jazz or anything? Is it just giving you a more enlivened, enriched way of looking at the way you approach music?
Yeah, it all plays a part into it. I mean, all those artists, if you, they're definitely comfortable being who they are. took that away from me, especially a guy like Frank Zappa and his music. A lot of people think about Frank Zappa as, like, you know, I just use him as an example, but they think about him as, you know, oh, rock and roll, political rock, kind of weird. But when you listen to the compositions and you see the instrumentation, you start to listen to it on a deeper level, he's more like a 20th century composer. He's just not using the orchestra. Maybe he is using the orchestra on some things. He's just more focused on electric guitar. Yeah. And so it all plays a part, you know, like they're all in my album collection. So if I go to sit down to write a tune, I'm not just going to think about it. Like, you know, if I go to sit down as a jazz musician to write a tune, if I dig in my album collection, I have more than just jazz albums. So all that plays a part into what I'm bringing to my music.
Yeah.
So the groove, you know, aspects of electronic music, everything plays a part into that. Even classical. I've been playing classical piano before I was playing anything else or could even play anything else.
Yeah.
So that has a huge part in it too. And, you know, maybe the harmony or the forms, or not to get all like technical with it or whatever, but
how were your years at Texas Southern University down in Houston? Did you learn a lot? What were the big growth periods down there for you?
Just the whole overall experience, I guess. Overall, I mean, I guess, and not to talk about the school, just where I was, you know, when you're just now getting into jazz and you really don't know anything about how to play it, ran into a lot of roadblocks with that, just between teachers and students. I learned a lot. It was a great, you know, period for growth because, like I said, I didn't know how to play jazz. So, like, I spent those 5 years at Texas Southern learning how to do that, whether it was with the teacher or not. Mostly it was without the teacher. But just being around kids, that kind of did it for me. Like, to be in combo and see kids your age creating music on the spot was a powerful thing. You know, that was a powerful thing. And then the journey of learning how to do that. When you grow up in Houston, of course, you're going to play a lot of R&B. You're going to play a lot of gospel. You're going to play a lot of hip-hop. You're going to play a lot of everything, probably, but jazz. Yeah. But it all goes together, and that's where I'd say I learned how to groove. You know, like a lot of the groove music and modern jazz stuff that I hear is really, a lot of the forward-moving stuff is coming out of guys from Houston. You know, actually, they all come from the same high school. I mean, Jason Moran and Robert Glasper and Jamar Williams group, or Aramage, and all these, you know, Walter Smith and all these other great, there's a whole list of great jazz musicians and a lineage that comes from that city, you know, starting with Joe Sample and the whole Third Ward area. So being at Texas Southern was a very important part, even though I might have had a negative experience from the overall school. I mean, that, it all carries on now. I wouldn't be grooving how I was. Or I wouldn't really be thinking about music like that if I wasn't there. I remember being at Texas Southern, and the first jazz album that I personally purchased was Robert Glasper's Mood, which is his first album before Blue Note. I still love that album to this day. It's a great album. His playing on that is very unique. And it just touched me. Like, his playing and a couple of the other guys playing was like, oh, wow. So you could do this with this music. You don't just have to do what I had been hearing, you know?
So why did you come to Kansas City? What was the motivation to leave where you were at to come up here?
I left Houston, and I ended up in Kansas City kind of by I'd say the Lord works in mysterious ways. So I was at a clinic, and we were playing a clinic for Theo Marcellus, U of H. I met the head of the jazz department at K-State by the name of Dr. Wayne Goins. And we talked a little bit, and that clinic was a really interesting experience. You know, definitely wasn't like the best playing I had done, but when I met Wayne, he was one of the few guys that it came up to me that, you know, heard something in my sound that maybe I hadn't heard yet. And he was talking about coming to K-State or just being interested in the Kansas area. I had my eye on New York for other obvious reasons. All my Houston friends are there. And, you know, and I heard him, and we talked a little bit. I didn't end up going to K-State, but he told me about UMKC and Bobby Watson. And I ended up auditioning for the school and coming out here. I knew my dad's side of the family. He was from Kansas City. And so just for the yearning to meet them, I came to Kansas City, auditioned, met my dad's side of the family for the first time. And then it was just pretty much done. I met Dominique Sanders first in the audition room, and we just hit it off. And I think that same day, you know, a guy that I just met dropped me off at the American Jazz Museum for the Monday night jam session, and I just saw all these young guys my age just, like, killing music. Like, they knew it. They were having fun with it. You know, I think it was, like, 20 guys on stage, all younger than 30, that could play extremely well. And I felt like, man, this was a scene that I wanted to be a part of or go to school at. And, of course, Bobby and Dan Thomas are super cool guys. And so it just made sense.
Absolutely. It's a perfect storm. You played with Roy Hargrove, Joe Chambers, Bobby Watson, Logan Richardson. You've been around. You played with a lot of really legendary kind of people. What's it like to get on stage with someone that has that much clout and experience and professionalism? What's the feeling you have when you play with them?
Man, just definitely got to come to the table with the knowledge of improvisation, because they're coming to the table with that great knowledge of improvisation. And, you know, it's very humbling, really. Like, I have fun playing with all of them, and learned a lot from all, you know, all the experiences of playing with them. You know, it's kind of crazy. And so just hanging on for the ride, and there's always things to learn, you know. I'm always trying to grow deeper into the language of jazz and the history and knowledge of it while, you know, keeping a foot in where we are now, but always digging deeper. And so all those guys are, you know, great examples and experiences and that you can learn from, you know, especially with a guy like Logan to, you know, Joe Chambers. I played with Joe Chambers in a big band situation with UMKC, where we did a concert or a series of concerts with Bobby. And being in the rhythm section and hearing that swing that he has, you know, and playing into that, you know, I think the most important thing about jazz that we can never forget is to always be you. And all these guys, people appreciate because they're them, unapologetic, you know, especially Logan and Roy. I mean.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about the Outer Circle.
Okay. I put together the Outer Circle when I was in, like, my last year of graduate school at UMKC. It was really a combination of guys that I had started playing with in school. I originally wanted to do a trio. Well, we were in a trio situation with Dominique and Ryan Lee with while we were in school, just kind of getting used to playing like that. I never really played trio because I was at a school where we didn't have that. And I had been writing music even when I was in Houston, so wanting to play my stuff with guys that I had been playing with either in school or in jam sessions. And I've always wanted to have a band because I'm a writer. So kind of formed like that. It's been through a few changes with members just because I guess that's how it goes. You know, everyone's doing different things.
Yeah.
But, you know, released our debut album, The Freedom of Expression, while we were all still in school with all pretty much UMKC guys. You know, Matt Hopper and Matt Leifer's on it, and Dominique and Andy McGee and Ryan Lee and, you know, a couple other, my roommate at the time, Eric Bloom, and we were all just going to school writing music. And I wasn't going to wait for guys to call me to play. I was just going to put together my own thing and start playing music. You know, I think that's what it's about. And the time is now, you know, getting your voice out and contributing to the lineage of jazz. So I wanted to kind of start doing that. I thought it was the perfect time to maybe step out on a limb and start recording and start playing and helping us grow. You know, it's always good to have guys that are better than you in the band so that you can always learn and grow from it. So
seems like you've kind of followed a theme, your Outer Circle, which would probably be Kansas City, the arc that you went towards, and the Freedom of Expression. It sounds like that's exactly what you did with these guys.
For sure. I chose the actual name, the Outer Circle, my roommate and I were sitting around talking, and it's like, you know, I've always kind of been an outer circle kind of person, never the guy that's like in the middle of the crew, or like if there is an inner circle, then I always felt like I was that while always, or outer, or while it's mainly the communication. Like if you think about the way the traditional rhythm section is set up, from like stage left piano, and then bass being in the crook of the piano, and the drums on the other side, and then if you have a quartet, that fourth member is out front, whether it's saxophone or guitar. And so it's this outer circle of communication.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a big fan of Miles Davis and Second Quintet. And when I listen to these groups that, you know, like how we keep talking, jazz is a language. There's a conversation going on stage. There's certain things that, you know, information that you have to digest and assess to create the music. You know, you have to take in all the information coming from the piano, the bass, and the drums, and all that. So it was really a thing that we had been working on, and the group really operates like that. We're really big on communication and really big on continuing in the conversation and growing and painting a clearer picture. And yeah. So it just made sense. The name stuck. We ran through a couple other names that my friends were like, never, we're not doing that. So I'm not going to voice those, but we went with the right one.
Yeah, that's cool. So you've talked a lot about the people that you respect and admire in the world of music, you know, Miles Davis, Zappa, and all these guys. If there's one person, whether it's jazz or any other genre, there's one musician, alive or not, that you could actually get to a spaceship or a time machine and meet, who would it be and what would you talk about?
I'd say Miles Davis. I say that because his music, you know, spans from the era of bebop with those young albums with Charlie Parker and Dizzy, where bebop is new and it's something new, you know, it's a breakaway from the swing that they're doing, you know, to, you know, his last album or one of his later albums, I believe in the 90s, like Doo-Wop, which is almost like a hip-hop album, which is a hip-hop album, really.
Yeah.
You know, and if you have, you know, his voice is imprinted in the lineage of time and all the different eras of jazz. Like, he's one of the first dudes to do electric and, you know, the Second Quintet and the First Quintet and, you know, to his thing with Marcus Miller to, and all those are pivotal albums. I think if I could ask him questions, I really admire how he builds his band, the musicians that he chooses to play with, and his whole philosophy on, A, the music, which I hate to even call it jazz, but the philosophy on that and how he goes about getting guys to really let loose and getting his, you know, the members in his band to truly, freely express themselves, you know. Anyone who's played with Miles Davis and that is still alive right now has a pretty pivotal career.
Yeah.
You know, Kenny Garrett, you know, Ron Carter, Herbie Hancock, you know, there's a really long list. Keith Jarrett played with Miles, even though Keith Jarrett was against playing electric at the time. He still played with Miles because there were things to learn, and he wanted to get that experience. I think that is a real pivotal artist in the jazz lineage that maybe gets forgotten about. I mean, in school they didn't really talk about him that much, but his electric side, you know, like Bitches Brew and Cellar Door Sessions and, you know, like, all those albums are great. And that whole concept changed everything.
Yeah.
So I'd say that he's my favorite for sure.
You know, I interviewed Jimmy Cobb and we were talking. You know, he's gone on to have a great career. You know, he was talking about Kinda Blue, and he said, you know, we just went in there and we just busted it out. You know, they just, all of them got together. They all just played as hard as they could. And he still to this day seemed like he was kind of surprised that there's been such a hula-boo, but I think that's what these musicians have kind of said about Miles. When you got in a room with him, you expected to play your best. He expected that without even saying
right.
to you. You know?
Right. So he would, he was like, I remember reading an article and he would, like, or, you know, an interview from Herbie or something, and he would specifically say, like, and I don't want to hear you play, regurgitate that stuff that you're practicing. He used different language, but I'm not going to.
Yeah,
you know, he was like, come here and come play some fresh stuff. Like, you've been practicing that, but I don't want to hear that. And yeah. So, you know, it's that whole thing. And, I mean, if you think about how jazz education is now, and I'm a sole product of jazz education. I didn't learn how to play jazz anywhere else but school. And then I went out to jam sessions and in the streets to, like, cultivate that and get better at that and really see how it was. And, you know, school is really a big on transcribing. And I'm not saying transcribing is bit, like, not is bad, because you definitely need to do that. But they're really big on, like, I guess, like, regurgitating a lot of that language to show validation in a little bit. I kind of hear it that way. You know, like, if you're not saying this, then maybe you don't know the language. Well, that's not necessarily true. You know, maybe when do we get a chance to speak our voice? And I really think Miles was big on finding guys who were already speaking their own voice while pushing them to cultivate their voice a lot more. Make it more potent and a little bit more clear. So,
what's the greatest thing about waking up every day?
Yeah, that's a good one. Right now, the greatest thing about waking up every day is waking up to music. Like, I literally wake up every day at about noon or 1 o'clock, and only thing I'm thinking about is writing and playing music or practicing or growing in music so that I can better share that art with people. You know, we're moving people. Like, music is all about moving people. Like, that's all it's really about.
Yeah.
You know, to either wash away problems or to, you know, express a problem that other people, we're all human, you know, that we're going through. So I'm blessed that I have this talent, and I'm definitely not trying to waste it. And so the best thing about waking up every day is to do that.
Right on. So let's say we reconvene on February 10, 2025, and we talk about, so if we get together in 10 years from now, if we're in 2025 and we talk, and I'm like, so what's been going on? What are you going to be happy? What's going to be on the top of your list that you're going to be happy that happened or that you had done or accomplished?
I don't know. I mean, the sky's the limit. So I have a lot of things written in, like, say, 10-year goals that I definitely think are possible. Hopefully the band is still together and I'm still in a position to create music with the utmost freedom. And there are people that are still, you know, as long as people are still listening and engaged in improvised music, then I don't know. I can't say. Hopefully a lot. I won't ever stop. So.
Right. Very cool. What's the greatest thing about Kansas City?
The greatest thing about Kansas City is our scene. I think Kansas City is really a city that's slept on a lot. Just maybe, you know, geographic location. And I think a lot of people know the history of Kansas City, which is a great thing. Like, the city has a great history in jazz. You hear about it in the streets. You know, I'm a young dude who lives in Westport. And as I walk to the Foundry or I walk to, you know, Beer Kitchen, I do hear bebop on the street. I do hear Charlie Parker through the radio. I hear John Coltrane through the radio. And a lot of people my age might ignore it, or my people be like, oh, man, what's that? Like, I don't know what that is. But they're playing that because of the history that we have in the city.
Yeah.
You know, I think also because of the, you know, the conservatory and, you know, Dan and Bobby being here and a lot of guys coming for the school. So the scene is still young. Like, there's a lot of young guys on the scene who have a lot of great potential. And so it's a small little tight-knit unit or scene where everyone, you know, there's a jam session every night here. You can go and get sharp, you know, and stay in the woodshed all the time in Kansas City and, you know, coupled with the cost of living here.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you could do music all day, all night, you know, if you want, and not have to really worry about how to make ends meet necessarily, opposed to, like, say, if you were on the coast or any, you know, and another, so I mean, coming from Houston, you know, cost of living is cheap in Texas as well. But, and, yeah, you know, but the scene is really great. It's really strong. It has a lot of support because of the history. I think a lot of things are changing here for the better.
Yeah.
And it's great. I like Kansas City a lot. I just want, you know, trying to always promote diversity in music. And it's really good, man.
Yeah, I think you guys really ushered in a level of renaissance town that's very refreshing. I mean, there's all something going on in this town.
Guys have been here. I had, guys like Peter Lamb and, you know, Herman Mahari and Ryan Lee and Dominique Sanders and, you know, even on the, I think, you know, even on the reggae side. You know, Kansas City doesn't really support reggae, but there are huge reggae bands here. 77 Jefferson's here, and they're like one of the main reggae, you know, Midwest reggae band hubs. Like, if anyone comes to the Midwest, they're going to look them up. I play with them as well. I mean, going on tour with Groundation. And, you know, the scene here in Kansas City is really, really strong. A lot of people don't hear about it, but they will shortly.
Absolutely.
They're starting to already, you know.
Yeah, without a doubt. So in the length of brevity, I bring this interview down to a very small thing, but there's power and small levels of words. In the length of tweet, tell me who you are. Who do you think you are?
I'm a young musician trying to contributing to the lineage of American music of here, coming from, you know, the history and what we've learned on improvised music and just music in general. I'm another young guy who plays music with our voice and writing and getting that out.
Beautiful. That's great, man. Hey, Eddie, it was great talking to you, man. Continue success, and hopefully I'll catch you out there live at some point here.
Cool. Appreciate it. Thanks for reaching out.
I'm here for you guys, man. Take it easy. Thank you.
All right. Peace.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York, Kansas City, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Eddie Moore for his insight and his stories. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store or visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.